From Studio H3 in the Current Affairs World Headquarters, it's Current Affairs, your ears' greatest hour of politics and culture. Today on the program, we learn about the Green New Deal, the panel discusses the loneliness epidemic, and we all share what we think is the worst example of American political amnesia. Our panel today: Current Affairs Senior Editor Brianna Renix.
Hello, everyone.
Current Affairs Contributing Editor Brianna Joy Gray.
Hi, guys.
Current Affairs Social Media Editor Vanessa A.B.
Hello.
And our Editor-in-Chief himself, Nathan J. Robinson.
Good evening.
I'm your host, Pete Davis. Let's begin with segment one. They actually know what they're talking about. In the recurring segment, They Actually Know What They're Talking About, we talk to people who actually know what they're talking about a thing people are talking about. This week's topic, the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal was once a glimmer in Jill Stein's eye, but now, thanks to the insurgent Sunrise Movement and congressional superstar Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the idea of a Green New Deal to solve the climate crisis has entered the mainstream. Congress people are signing on by the dozen. Presidential candidates are shoring up their progressive bona fides by voicing approval. It might just get its own congressional committee. But what exactly is a Green New Deal? We bring on today someone who knows what they're talking about, Stephen O'Hanlon of the Sunrise Movement, to help answer the question. But before we get to Stephen, we...
who don't know what we're talking about.
Yes, we who don't know what we're talking about are going to talk a bit for a few minutes about the political implications of the Green New Deal. And then we'll throw it to Stephen to talk about some of the details. So, panel, are you excited about the Green New Deal?
Cory Booker's on board, so I'm down.
Our resident Booker head, Brianna Joy Gray.
That is not a thing. Please don't spear me with that. No, but that's just to speak to the idea that it's kind of remarkable, the kind of broader acceptance among the more traditional, I hesitate to use the word neoliberal ilk, is impressive.
Yeah, and I feel like a big theme of 2016, that kind of distinguished Hillary Clinton from Bernie Sanders was this idea of like feasibility and who's proposing ideas that can actually catch on with like the American people. And there was this idea that Hillary Clinton was the reasonable one, and she was pushing, you know, like basically, she's really good at like not biting more than she can chew. I don't know if I'm using that expression correctly, but I feel like AOC flips that on its head. You know, is she even sworn in?
No,
she's not sworn in. She's tweeting about the Green New Deal. She's passionate about it. She has these activists on board. And all of a sudden, Cory Booker is on board, like a 2020 candidate. You know, it just goes to show, like, if a program is a good idea, it doesn't matter if we've never done it before. It doesn't matter if it's ambitious. You put it out there and then you figure out the details later. Anyway, I'm very excited about it. And I think the French are actually also trying to get a Green New Deal going, at least this socialist candidate, Benoît Hamon, who is polling very, very, very low. But I just find it exciting that, like, globally, and also that other the Greek guy, Yanis,
Varoufakis.
Yanis V is on board with the Green New Deal. It's just catching fire. You know, I'm excited to see what will happen.
Yeah. I mean, we might have to be careful about how we use that point in arguing for it in the U.S. If we're like, well, the French socialists are behind it. I don't know that that's going to play well, but...
I used to do minimum wage activism, and the basic like kind of liberal minimalist rule was the more ambitious you get with a project, the smaller your coalition is. So you might as well have a minimalist project because then you'll please the most amount of people and it can be passed. But actually, what's great about minimum wage activism is it's actually like a literal perfect measure of extremism, because the higher the number, the more extreme the idea is. And you could actually just have a graded scale of like by exact proportions how bigger it is. And we were fighting for like $10. And there was like a certain amount of enthusiasm. Obama was fighting for $9. There was less enthusiasm. And then the fight for 15 was fighting for $15. And there was more enthusiasm. So it actually was completely reversed. And when you think about it, the reason it was completely reversed is if you're fighting for a $9 minimum wage, your constituency who's affected by it are people who make between $7.25 and $9. If you're fighting for a $15 minimum wage, your constituency who's affected by it is people who make between $7.25 and $15. That's a much bigger set of people who are ready and excited about this. And the people at $7.25 are much more excited to feel like it's worth sticking your neck out for because it's going to be a big thing. So if you're fighting for a tiny thing like, well, now it's tiny, I guess, by Green New Deal standards, cap and trade, you know, who knows if it'll work? It'll be confusing. Who knows if it'll actually fight climate change? Who knows if it'll have a thing? I'm not that jazzed about it. But then suddenly when you're doing a Green New Deal that's going to create 10 million jobs and have a real shot at fighting climate change and remake our economy, suddenly there's all these constituencies and all these big things that it's worth sticking your neck out for because a big thing could happen. So the entire conventional wisdom is on its head about what causes excitement.
It has also been pointed out that minimal demands violate the first rule of negotiation, which is that you're supposed to ask for more than the thing you would settle for. When 515 came out, I was kind of shocked because it seemed unrealistic to me at the time. Because if we remember, you know, minimum wage is $7. and you thought, and usually it had been, you know, well, we'll push for $9. And then it went 15 and you thought, that is crazy. You can't go for 15. And then it caught on massively. And, you know, and actually turns out to be quite realistic. Often things turn out to be way more realistic than you assume they are. The Green New Deal has caught on really, really quickly. I mean, about a month and a half ago, I think, I wrote an article called, like, what's the climate equivalent of Medicare for All going to be? Which was saying, you know, climate change is a civilization-destroying threat. We should probably have it as one of the quick, slogan-y pillars of the progressive platform like Medicare for All and Free College. And yet, we haven't seemed to all coalesce around this thing. And then, you know, I sort of totally missed the fact that at that very moment, this coalescing was going on, and now we have that. It's the consensus position. I mean, there's still debate about what it's going to be, but...
Alexandra, thank you for reading Nathan's article. We really appreciate it.
It's very more like quick, I forgot very to read quick her work. Twitter feed.
We really appreciate it.
Yeah. I do feel like it's going to depend a little bit how it's pitched, though. Because we read a number of articles about this to prepare for this podcast, which is why we're all incredibly knowledgeable now. But one of them started out with something like, oh, like in the future, everyone's going to live in these kind of like government compounds that are like prefabricated with like restaurants and bars, and then they're going to go to their green job. And I feel like that was probably like not, like, I don't know that everyone would see that and like be excited to be like, oh, government housing is going to be the norm and everyone's going to live in it. Versus, like, it's a jobs guarantee, which tends to be something that people are excited about.
Yeah. And I hope, I mean, you know, this is to be determined since we haven't seen much of what AOC can or will be able to do in the future. But I think it's important that the left learn to pitch the exact program that it's pushing, but in terms that either seem appealing to Republicans or that at least would make them look bad in trying to make our ideas look bad to their constituents, you know? So there's a way to pitch the Green New Deal that's all about jobs, that's all about incentivizing innovation, funding good green ideas. You know, like there's a huge element, like, of course, hopefully some of it, most of it will be public funded, but it's not always direct, right? Like there are opportunities there to also subsidize like private actors to change their practices the way we do now in supporting them with, like, you know, using fossil fuels and things, you know, and like energy sources that we think are bad for the environment. You know, the point being that I think that there's a way here to pitch the Green New Deal that's like, that you can sell to everyone. And government attorneys do this with every change of internally with like every change of administration. You know, you just learn to speak the new language so that your work survives. And, you know, as you pitch the new the new people in charge on why you should keep doing the thing that you're doing and why it's important for the American people, and politicians should be able to do that too.
I think that's true. And I, you know, I'm like a geek for communication strategies. My concern though also is that we're going to see what has kind of happened with the resistance to Medicare for All, where very effective messaging has made it incredibly popular among actual normal people who don't have healthcare, for instance. But Li Feng wrote an article a couple of weeks ago, I think, where he talks about the documents that leaked that show that there was this coordinated bipartisan effort to basically start to change the messaging. And Democrats are basically doing it by saying, you're attacking the ACA, you're undermining Obamacare, you're undermining Obama, which is a hop, skip, and a jump to you're racist. You know, Republicans are doing it by doing what they always say and just saying it's, you know, corporate death panels and all the things that we've heard the whole time. But what's so distressing is that there are ostensibly two parties who are listening to the same overlord, and that there is such a coordinated effort to try to undermine well-earned public enthusiasm. And I wonder if the Green New Deal starts to really gain traction the way Medicare for All has, if we're going to start to see some more of that kind of coordinated pushback, and then no messaging in the world can you know, can beat, you know, that kind of corporate power. Unless it gets so overwhelming that you just can't be in office unless you're on board.
Yeah, it seems like the type of, you know, how like one way they're taking on Medicare for All is they're saying, oh, I'm for universal health care, but it's actually like tax credits or something. You know, oh, and thus I endorse Medicare for All, but this is my Medicare for All. It's called like, it's whatever. Like Green New Deal seems very susceptible to that. Like, oh, you know, Democrats pass Green New Deal. It ends up being like subsidies to R&D. For, you know, Exxon to research, you know, transitioning. Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to add, just respond to what Vanessa was saying, because I think it is incredibly important to package things in ways that can draw broad appeal and aren't alienating and speak languages that everybody can understand. And you have to have some people who are Republicans on your side because they are a significant part of the country to some degree. But I also am always very careful about making what I call left-wing arguments using right-wing premises or their language and allowing their language to become the dominant language. So you got to be super careful because soon you might end up going, well, we want the Green New Deal because it will cut the ultimately it will cut the deficit and grow the economy. And if you start becoming that person, I feel like you end up losing a little bit when you erode the power of left language and start framing things and you go, well, actually, if you believe in all these conservative values, you should support the thing because we are the real ambassadors for conservative values. So I'm always dealing with the difficult tension between how much do you concede.
Yeah, and you run the risk that if, you know, the plan works, but it doesn't live up to the conservative values, but lives up to all the, like, it saves the planet, but it's, like, slightly not deficit neutral, suddenly you're like, oh, gosh, I have to be against the plan now because I pitched it on something that wasn't the real reason I was for the plan. The group that I really like about how are you going to pay for it, which is the obvious, like, number one argument against this, is... I love like Stephanie Kelton and the famed deficit owls from episodes 1 and 2 who are fighting these deficit hawks. They always say, how are you going to pay for not doing the program? And they always try to divert from the fake budget, like budget deficit, which they're arguing is not as important. It's mostly inflation. You should be watching, not the literal budget deficit, to the reality in the economy and in society of underinvesting in the public like projects. So one thing we can always say is, you know, if a Republican doesn't have a climate change plan, there is a fee that there are going to be huge costs to climate change. We need to get a number. Like someone has that number somewhere of what the costs to climate change, if it goes unabated, of the next 50 years are. And we need to start telling Republicans, I understand you don't have a global warming plan, but how are you going to pay for it? And they're going to because how are you going to pay for not having one?
Yeah. Like who's going to pay for that sun dimming thing that they've been talking about lately, where they're going to fire a bunch of shit into the atmosphere to like reduce the amount of sun that's getting in. It's going to be expensive.
Green New Deal's totally cheap. Green New Deal's the bargain sun dooming.
I do reflect on Professor John Hansen, who I know that many of us had in law school.
Friend of the
conversations,
pod.
Friend of the pod. Conversations about kind of a failure to tally externalities as part of what creates these inequities in tort law and other in corporate law and other areas. I don't know exactly how to get around that problem. You know, there's a legal problem here where it's difficult to trace causation and who's responsible for all of these things. But in a world where we're talking about kind of like global ruin, it becomes less about that causality problem and just about this like pure, how can we put a number on all of these bad things that are happening? And so I'm increasingly optimistic that we can get to a point where the full force of things like the cost of these wildfires in California start to, industry that's failing, fishing industries, people who are losing coastline. There was a great piece in The Dig a couple of weeks back about how all these conservatives down in the South who had these marshland communities were really negative when you talked to them about global warming. But when you talked to them about the realities of what was happening to them on their land and kind of avoided liberal buzzwords, were really on board with the lefty program. So I'm all about leveraging those kind of tallies of externalities to try to get even those right-wing business people on board, because that's real. That's not me necessarily like pandering, I think, to a right state of mind. I think that's just a real contrast to set up between the two relative costs. So do we have a clear definition that we would want? You know, are there lines we can start to draw about what a clean New Deal does and doesn't mean, the way we all kind of have a sense that when people start talking about access to healthcare, that we're not on the same page, and that Medicare for All has become a kind of thing in and of itself that it seems to be easier to preserve?
Well, Bree, on that note, we have someone here with us who can help answer those questions. Let's go to the interview. I am here with Stephen O'Hanlon. He's a Philadelphian and is the communications director for Sunrise, a movement of young people taking on the influence of fossil fuel executives in our political system. Stephen, welcome to Current Affairs.
Thanks for having me, Pete.
To the average politics follower, the Sunrise movement came out of nowhere. Most had not heard of it at all, and then suddenly it became the most exciting movement in American politics today, all in the last month. Could you tell us, as the old saying goes, how long does it take for things to happen? It takes a very long time and then all at once. So I'd love to hear the story of the very long time. What is the origin of the Sunrise movement and this big idea at the center of it, the Green New Deal?
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, we've been thrilled at how we've seen such an upspring of support across the country for the movement and thousands of new people getting involved. We were founded, I was one of the co-founders along with seven other young people. In April of 2017, so a year and a half ago at this point. And we were coming from different parts of the youth climate movement, had done organizing around getting our schools and universities to stop investing in fossil fuels, helping to lead policy work at the state and federal and international level on climate change. And we all had the same sense that what we were doing was just nowhere near enough, was not measuring up against the scale of the crisis. So we launched Sunrise, and for the last year and a half, we've been organizing and building the movement all across the country. And then right after the election, when we sat in at Nancy Pelosi's office, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined the sit-in, and it really catapulted the Green New Deal and our movement into the national spotlight.
And when you say that you were unhappy with the way that the movement was going, what were you unsatisfied with? Because, you know, it's always been in the background. You know, we might get a carbon tax one day. We, you know, 10 years ago, it was cap and trade. What were you unsatisfied with?
We'd just seen our entire lives politicians talking about taking action on climate change, and then sometimes proposing solutions that barely put a dent in it, and usually not accomplishing much of anything. And we were Yeah, we had seen the people who, the quote unquote adults in the room, fail us for our whole lives. And we wanted to build a movement of young people that were ready to actually push for the solutions that we need and build the political and public support behind them to actually get them through.
And what's been so interesting about the Green New Deal to us is that the climate justice movement has often been dour and negative. It's bad news and tough choices and saying no to a bunch of things. But the Sunrise Movement and the Green New Deal are reframing it all as positive. We're going to remake our economy. We're going to provide jobs. We're going to fight inequality. We're going to fight climate change all at once. Was that a conscious choice? Was that part of the idea that this is going to be a large kind of positive alternative program?
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the reasons I'm so excited about the Green New Deal, because, you know, if you look at the science and take that seriously, in order to actually transform our economy with the speed and scale that we need to give our generation a livable future, we're going to need massive changes in our economy. And we're going to be going up against some of the most wealthy and powerful people in the world who profit off of continuing to burn fossil fuels. And to overcome that politically, we're going to need a mass political movement. And quite frankly, we can't build that by just saying no to things. We need to actually show a positive vision for what we can do and how it'll improve people's lives. And I think that the Republican Party's attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act really illustrates this point. You know, we saw people mobilize in record numbers, and thousands of people who'd never been involved in politics before came out, went to rallies, lobbied their members of Congress because something really tangible, their healthcare, was threatened. And, you know, it's hard to get people excited about a carbon tax that's sort of wonky and sort of abstract, and lets the opposition paint it as a tax hike, which we saw this year when fossil fuel PACs and lobbyists defeated climate measures in Oregon, Washington and other states. So we need to be talking about how this is a huge opportunity for us to improve the lives of millions of Americans. And just some polling out this week from the New York Times shows that this is widely supported across political party when people hear about how it'll impact their lives.
So let's get into that vision. On a policy level, what actually is the Green New Deal? What are the major elements of it?
Yeah, so, you know, the Green New Deal, it's going to include many policies, many pieces of legislation. Part of the reason we want this select committee on a Green New Deal is to actually dig into the work of figuring out exactly what that looks like. So I can sort of show you some of the broad policy goals, but it's going to be quite expansive. So one major goal is moving our country to 100% renewable energy over the next 12 years, which is in line with what the latest UN climate report says we need to do. And it's about guaranteeing a job with fair and livable wages to anyone who wants one, stopping the climate crisis. And there will be jobs in, you know, transforming our public transit systems and upgrading them, renovating buildings, thousands and thousands, maybe millions of buildings, for energy efficiency, upgrading our energy grid so that we can handle the newest renewable technology, and the list goes on. It'll be about working to eliminate poverty and elevate communities that have been historically marginalized. And we see this as really important for our whole lifetimes. We've seen that communities, working class, poor communities, and communities of color who are on the front lines of poverty and pollution have really been hurting. And this is an opportunity to use this transition as a time to really uplift those communities.
Okay, so to get really concrete, one thing I'm hearing is a huge infrastructure project, green infrastructure project, which leads to a bunch of public jobs, which are administered through like a green jobs program. Is that basically one way to think about it, that it's just a giant infrastructure project, just like how the New Deal consisted of thousands of different infrastructure projects that had jobs programs in them, like the Civilian Conservation Corps? Is there also a carbon tax that's part of this?
There could be. We think it can definitely be a part of it. Some kind of carbon pricing mechanism definitely has a place in the Green New Deal. That's just only going to be part of the policy, because you know, 20 years ago, maybe we could have had a carbon pricing system that you know, slowly moved us away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy. But at this point, we need a transition so rapid that if you really look at the economics and the science, there's not a whole lot of possibility of a carbon tax moving us away at the scale we need to actually give our generation a livable future.
And 12 years sounds very rapid, but there have been mm-hmm. times in American history where we've mobilized wildly. You know, the World War II is the best example yeah. where we as a country creatively, rapidly transformed our entire economy for the sake of a international crisis. So do you mm-hmm. does the movement think about that precedent a lot?
Yeah. We see that and the original New Deal as precedents in the 20th century for this kind of transition. It's going to need to be a massive transition and a mass mobilization of our whole country. But we, you know, it's worth it. Our ability to like preserve life as we know on this planet, which sounds like a hyperbole, but when you actually look at the science, it's not. That's what's at stake.
It also seems to me that it could be also a cultural thing because, you know, William James, the old turn of the century philosopher, said that America needs the moral equivalent of war. Because he noticed that during the Civil War, mm. people felt patriotic, people felt like tied together, they mm-hmm. felt part of something. But the downside mm-hmm. was, you know, hundreds of thousands of people died. So we don't want war to be the thing that brings us together. So he wrote this famous essay, The Moral Equivalent yeah. of War. And it seems like what you're proposing is the moral equivalent. It's a mobilization for the sake of a major thing. And it could have cultural effects on being the generation that does this.
And I think we're seeing young people especially just feeling really empowered to step up and to change politics. And we're seeing with the Green New Deal, with the March for Our Lives movement, how young people have a real ability to change politics in this country.
So moving to the politics, how can people get involved with the Sunrise Movement?
We have people organizing all across the country, dozens of different hubs. So you should check out our website, sunrisemovement.org, where you can find ways to get involved, whether it's joining a local group. You can make calls and tweet at representatives to get them to back the Green New Deal. And you can find, there's also lots of ways to get involved online. So definitely check out the website. But you know, we've seen over these past few weeks how it's people coming together, going to their representative offices, making calls, doing sit-ins in Washington, D.C. that can change politics. So we're in a really incredible moment and we need everyone to jump on.
And I assume the presidential campaign is going to be a big moment and you're going to do the same thing you did to Pelosi's office. I assume you're going to do to all the candidates as well to try to get them
well,
to sign up.
Yeah, we don't want to get into the plans for 2019 yet. But
could you confirm, Stephen, that there are plans for 2019?
There are plans. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens.
Thank you, Stephen. My final question is, I have a theory that all political movements need an emoji. And is it true that the Sunrise Movement partially chose that name because there is a sunrise emoji that you can put on all your tweets or handles and texts? And
well, it is on all of our handles. we chose the sunrise because we were founding the movement just months after Trump was elected, and there was, a lot of us were feeling the weight of what was going on politically and also ecologically, and we hold a belief that we actually can like bring the sunrise, and then if we organize together, like this day, this like dark day in America can end, and we can actually stop the crisis.
Amen to that, Stephen. Thank you for doing your part and for all that your organization does to bring on the sunrise. You give me a lot of hope, and I'm sure you're going to give many of the listeners listening out there a lot of hope. So keep up the good fight, Stephen.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This episode is sponsored by the Current Affairs Radio Archive. Anyone who stops by the listening room at the Current Affairs World Headquarters can browse clips from throughout the program's 85-year run. In this clip from 1942, we hear a bit from Red Rose, the flagship production of the short-lived Current Affairs Radio Theater.
La time on Red Rose, our heroine battled arch nemesis Amarantha Stone and was sucked into a pocket dimension. An evil future in which socialism is no more. What horrors await Red Rose, her long-suffering sidekick Lucy, and the bumbling agent Jack Roland in this unimaginable universe?
Is it New York? London?
Mr. Pop?
I don't know, but it's some kind of fashion nightmare.
Look at those gated-off restaurants! Amazon security guards! And all these people jostling each other on the sidewalk, look! They've got words and numbers floating above their heads!
Looks like work orders. The name of the job, the number of hours, and the rate. That number's always going down.
I gotta say, this place doesn't look fun, but at least I don't see any Nazis. Maybe in this future, they didn't win.
I wouldn't speak so soon.
Hold on right now!
What are they doing to that lady? And her kid?
They didn't have that floating information above their heads. And now they're getting arrested.
Well, who knows what the rules are here? Maybe they, did something. Ow!
It was the crowd. Oh my God, Red! Is that?
Amarantha. Hello, Rosie. You made it. How do you like our future? Tell me, Amarantha, how much did the Nazis pay you for this? Oh, Rosie, you misunderstand. This isn't their future. Well, not exactly. The Nazis are on the ascendancy here, of course. They can never really go away, not when there's human misery to feed off of. But this future is the best of all possible worlds. All realistically possible worlds. Don't you see that, Rosie? This is a future where merit rises to the top. Where talent, like yours and mine, is finally fully realized through honest competition.
Funny. All I see is desperation.
Same difference, really. If you can't make it, you didn't deserve it.
So is that why innocent people are being dragged off the street?
Oh, it's a necessary side effect, I assure you. Some people just aren't useful, and others didn't enter the system the right way. They think they can shirk about, drain on resources just because, well, let's say the world outside the city isn't very nice. Not nice at all.
This world is unstable. It can't exist.
Miss Rose, this is a pocket dimension, a potential future. So, in its own way, it does exist.
It can't exist because it won't. People won't put up with something like this. Not for long. Not forever.
Rosie, what have you done?
Ah, look at that! Some people in the crowd have stopped fighting amongst themselves. They're turning around.
Rosie, we could have been happy here. Nah, you see, it wouldn't have lasted.
Ouch! Miss Lucy, you landed on my face.
Did I?
Axe, they have returned. The portal is collapsing. How is this possible?
I don't know, but that's what I get for having faith in you, Rosie. You'll always choose the world's happiness over your own.
Yeah, it's called being a decent person.
Miss Stone, once again, you're under arrest. She's gone.
Amarantha got away. Again.
Fräulein Stone, you forgot me.
Here, Roland, you're going to have this Nazi. Take him to a POW camp. Get a shiny medal.
Hey, Red! We don't want to get stuck in a lousy future here. We got a motor!
Tune in next time, dear listeners, for the future adventures of Red Rose, the globe-trotting socialist adventuress.
Hear more at the Current Affairs Radio Archive. We're back with segment two, once more into the breach. There is a lot of light in this world, but there is also a lot of darkness. We have the privilege of avoiding thinking about all the darkness in the world, and yet it is our responsibility to bear witness and offer help. Therefore, we have a recurring segment, Once More Into the Breach, in which we wade together back into the thick of a despair-inducing situation unfolding in our time. This week's topic, American loneliness. Back in the 1990s, social scientist Robert Putnam showed to wide interest that we as a nation were bowling alone. We are not participating in groups as much. We are not getting to know our neighbors. We are becoming more socially isolated. And in the two decades since, it has only gotten worse. Loneliness and social isolation is an American epidemic. It is leading to elderly suicide spikes. It is contributing to the opioid crisis. And it is wrapped up in all of the cultural and political crises we see around us today. The New York Times has even started a series on how to make friends to help its readers fight their isolation. It is a silent but significant part of the story of early 21st century America. Panel, what do we think about it? What is causing it? What should we do about it? Let's go once more into the breach.
So ever since college, there's been a running joke among myself and my college friends with whom I'm altogether too intimate, that if we got to a certain age, which now from the perspective of 33 is embarrassingly low, but once we got to that age, we would all live together in a commune if we weren't already married and paired off with kids. And this used to be something they all used to roll their eyes at and like think I was crazy about. And I thought that the word commune, maybe it's not great marketing, but they really picked on that as part of why they thought I was crazy. But as the years have gone by, even those who are partnered, in fact, especially those who are partnered, have become increasingly enthusiastic about this idea because they have kids and they like the idea of free childcare. They feel the burden of their stressful careers and their limited time. We all live across the country. None of us live in the same state, basically. And, you know, increasingly you realize that you kind of are able to choose your family. And, you know, 15, 17 years out of college, you know, or after freshman year, after you first meet these people, you realize that they're like some of the more substantive relationships in your life. But still, society doesn't really value the idea of making big, significant personal life choices to live next to your college friends. It does still seem creepy and crazy, regardless of whether or not you call it a commune. And, you know, I don't know. I think all the time about like, how we don't, I personally, let's just say, don't make choices that put my kind of social happiness first, because it does seem kind of insane to say I'm going to pick up and move to Chicago because that's where so-and-so is. But like, there's a world in which we do that, in which we're frankly encouraged to do that, because I know I certainly can't afford housing costs by myself anyway. It's the only way I'm going to be able to own, guys.
Yeah, every so often there's this thing about like, oh, a bunch of friends decided to move in somewhere. They all live next to each other and it goes viral online. And I think that's part of this crisis, which is that you're saying like the when you ask people what their happiest moments are, it was like moments when they were in deep community. And yet when you ask people like, what have you made your choices based on? They're always like, oh, I moved for a job or I moved for this opportunity. And no one ever says like that job was the best time in my life. They always say like my time with like feeling part of a dense social group was a time in my life.
Another part of it is that American culture particularly, and maybe this is the case for other Western countries, is just very individualistic, both culturally, but like economically, like the government, like housing policy, like zoning rules, housing benefits will go as far as dictating who can live under one roof and how they can be related to each other. And it like all goes back to favor the nuclear family. I think our tax system also incentivizes like being in these really tight knit families and limiting who we consider to be, you know, the parents in our households and children and dependents. And, you know, I think that's really harmful, and it's very different from the way, you know, other cultures around the world, particularly, I would say maybe even like in the global South, do things. You know, you think about like what happens when someone dies. And I'm a little bit of an outsider, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like in America, there's this culture of, you know, you stand a casserole, whatever it is. I've actually never had a casserole, so I don't quite know what it is, but you send a casserole, you send a nice card, maybe you go to the funeral if you're close enough to the family, and then you leave people alone, you let people grieve. There are other places around the world, like in Cameroon, for instance, where relatives that you have never met in your life will hear that your grandmother died, and they will descend into your house and they will live there for a month because we are all mourning together and no one turns anyone away. They just mourn together. And like when my mother has described this to me, like as someone who has like a little bit of like lone wolf tendencies, I was like, this sounds like a nightmare. But then looking back, it's like, I don't know, maybe you should be surrounded by a bunch of people when you're mourning, you know, and maybe because, you know, whenever you're with a lot of people, it's not just crying. Like these people might bring you joy. You might be able to just have a completely different experience. So Pete, you mentioned elderly population, aging people increasingly, you know, committing suicide, reporting high degrees of loneliness, reporting that, you know, the only times where they have interactions with other human beings are when, you know, maybe two or three times a week when the postman comes by or when their Meals on Wheels come by. And like, one, that's devastating. But two, like when you create an entire socioeconomic system that's like so deeply centered on this idea of like a small nuclear family, like, yeah, there's not going to be room for these people. And then you add to the fact that like we have this system where, you know, old people aren't guaranteed retiree pensions here. Benefits aren't necessarily keeping up with cost of living. Like, I think all these things make it difficult for families to take in, to like extend kindness and take in wayward relatives or take in aging people into their home, because then that's one more head that they have to support, one more mouth to feed, you know, like there just isn't enough. That can seem big. And sometimes it's like just easier to let the person be isolated. And I feel like that contributes to what we're seeing. But what do you guys think?
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's this book that I think Nathan gives to every single one of his friends at some point, which is called A Pattern Language. It's this book about like community planning and architecture and like how to like build community spaces that like combine like community with like a certain amount of privacy. And it has this thing in it that I love, which is that both teenagers and elderly people should live in cottages that are like attached to like a compound where like other families live, but are separate, because you need like a certain amount of like autonomy, but you also need like the ability for people to be checking up on you. You need to like be able to like go like have dinner maybe with people from time to time. And it sounds like a goofy idea, but it's actually kind of a very like doable thing that would make a lot of sense to try and find more kind of like architectural and structural solutions to the problem of loneliness, which is just like if you facilitated spaces where like elderly people could live close to other people, it would like reduce the need for people to be put in homes like before it's necessary. If they don't have family, they could maybe like have some kind of like association with like another family in their neighborhood that's not like a total caretaking situation, but is sort of like, you know, like a quasi helpful scenario. And it's a shame that we can't think of ways to facilitate that, because it seems like it would be doable in a lot of contexts.
It's amazing what can make a difference. I mean, I actually liked, I mean, the college dorms I lived in were ugly as hell. They were like miserable places, but I actually liked dorm living in many ways, because it had this combination of common areas and you had a private area that was your own, at least at After you got out of the first year where you had to live in a triple with two other people in a tiny, tiny space. There's nothing good about that, but it's not lonely. But then the combination of private space and communal space is really important. And I've noticed, you know, my parents, we moved to the country, just the three of us. So we had no connections, really. And it was so... you know, with nuclear family with no other family in the whole country. And the first neighborhood that we lived in for most of my life was just not set up in a way that facilitated meeting people and talking to people. We were in a cul-de-sac. And in a cul-de-sac, no one comes down your cul-de-sac. So if you don't leave the house, nobody's going to come by and say hello. You're going to be alone. And when I moved out of the house, I noticed that, you know, well, my parents seemed kind of alone in this house. And they moved a couple of years ago to a neighborhood that has, I think, some small differences that make a huge difference. Like, for this neighborhood is the street that they go down is a street that you would go down to get between things. So people, their friends, will be on the way to something and will just stop by the house and knock on the door and come in and say hello. And because it's on the way to stuff, so you can easily come by and say hello. And as a result, there are always, whenever I go home, there are always people dropping by. There are people dropping in constant. People are like, oh, I had some food. I thought I'd drop by and see if you wanted any. And it's just so lovely and it's so social and they live so much better now. But, you know, there's so much. One of the things that's so hard, too, is that in the United States, it's kept so hidden below the surface. There's so much despair that nobody really knows about. You know, I keep coming back, Brianna, to your article over and over, the article you wrote, Speaking of Despair, which is about your time working at a suicide hotline. And you have this line about how if misery made a sound like a siren, you would hear it wailing from everywhere. You would hear it shrieking from the end of the street and from the apartments next door. But it doesn't make a sound. It's just silence. So it's so easy to pass by all these doors along the street and not know what's going on behind them and who's sad and who needs you to, who would love it if you dropped in.
Yeah, no, I mean, during my time when I worked on the hotline, it was a hotline that sort of, it was sometimes would pick up calls from like the National Suicide Hotline, but it was also a regional suicide hotline. So a lot of times I would get calls from people that as they were talking to me, I would realize lived very close to me. And sort of the way that suicide hotlines work is like you don't disclose any personal information about yourself. You never make contact with the people that you speak to because you can imagine that would like create a lot of like potential logistical problems. So they absolutely forbid you from doing that. But it was very weird for me to realize that like some of the people I was talking to were very, very close to me. Like in theory, I could have like walked past their house before. I could have walked past them in the street and not known who they were. It's a weird experience working for a hotline like that because actually what you realize is most of the people who call those kinds of hotlines are not actively suicidal. Like I think people imagine with a suicide hotline that you're like talking to someone who's like standing on top of the building. You're like, no, don't do it. There's so much to live for. It's not like that at all. Like it's mostly just like really, really lonely people call and they're like, I want someone to talk to today. I haven't talked to anyone today. And it's really tough because, I mean, I'm glad that those kinds of resources exist, both for people who may be thinking about suicide and for people who are just sad. But what's depressing to me is that there are no kind of, again, we have no actual like dedicated like social programs or like creative solutions for these problems. Like, it would be like your kind of options on a hotline like that is like, I can talk to this person for like 15 minutes. Or if I think that they're in danger, I can send a like paramedic to their house. Like there's no in-between option where you could just like send someone to talk to them and say hi and or like sign them up for like some kind of program. Like there's nothing you can actually do for people. And sometimes when people are describing like what their lives are like and like how they have no contact with anyone, how they're like severely depressed or they're like really ill, or like everyone they love is dead or something like that. And like, you know, your job on that hotline is to sort of, you know, mostly to listen to them, but also to kind of like if they seem to be in danger, to kind of like, you know, figure out what are their kind of like safety factors, what kind of plan can they put in place to keep themselves safe. And I'll be honest with you, sometimes like people will be talking to me and I'd be like, I would want to be dead in this situation. Like I would already have done it. Like, and that's a really like dark place to be when you're talking to someone that you're supposed to be helping, where you're like, yeah, if I was in your shoes, I would not want to be alive. I don't know what to say to that. Like, I mean, to me, it seems like we need to find ways to, like, stop these situations from arising. Like, it's not enough to just talk to people and try and make them feel better for 15 minutes. Like, some of these problems are solvable. We just don't care enough.
You know, if something becomes, like, societally clinical in a broad sense of the word, like, what I'm hearing from this is, like, oh, if they commit a crime, then they get filed into the prison system. If they're, like, about to die, they get filed into the, like, health system. If they're, like, actively suicidal, they get filed into a cop will show up or a paramedic will show up. But, yeah, it's, like, we don't have this kind of soft middle of just, like, people who are having struggles and, like, what is the community answer to them? And one thing, one solution I have seen and, like, one thing I'm a big proponent of is I think we just – someone once said that a church – and this can be religious or secular – I guess one, maybe to make it a less intense term, I could say, like, just a community group that's devoted to each other, is it needs to have flourishing people, a good mix of flourishing and non-flourishing people. Because if it's all just flourishing people, it's not, like, being a benevolent, open-hearted organization. If it's all unflourishing people, they're not, you know, they're not there to help each other. They're kind of in need. And what was great about many of these civic organizations mid-century that have been in decline, many of which were churches and synagogues and mosques and the like, was they had a mix of flourishing people and non-flourishing people. And when there were non-flourishing people there, the community was interested in having the flourishing people surround them and keep them as part of the community. One thing I've noticed in our generation is that we have many less of these, like, community building, reaching out to people and, like, being there for them in a situation that might not be the most enjoyable and pleasant situation, that many in our parents' generation, when I hear my mom talk about it, it's like, oh, every day I was going and visiting Mrs. Wilson down the road. And then, you know, I had to go talk to Bobby because Mr. Patterson's son, Bobby, like, was in trouble and I was someone who could help him. And then I had to go down across the street. And then, like, we all had to meet at the Christmas party and half the people at the Christmas party, you know, I didn't particularly like, but it's, you got to do what you got to do. And meanwhile, when our family was in trouble, everyone swarmed and, like, helped us. And, like, we don't, a lot of, like, there's something on the soul level where, like, a lot of our generation is like, you should hang out with the optimally enjoyable people in your life. You choose your friends. Your friends are the ones you like that are the most like you. And I think we need to just have a higher tolerance for kind of being part of communities where not everyone's, like, not every interaction's totally pleasant and fun brunch. Like, some of it's like the obligations you have to do of, like, being there for people in your community. I don't know. What do folks think about that?
I think that my friends are highly non-flourishing.
You find the non-flourishing people that are right for you.
We need more flourishing people in our group, actually, maybe. Anyone want to merge?
Yeah, no, I think that's, I agree with what you said, Pete. I wonder if, like, if I try to picture, like, an anthropologist 100 years from now trying to get a sense of, like, the degree of loneliness in our generation and, like, using Twitter as a metric, I just wonder what they would think. Our generation, we're just, like, the shit posting generation, and it's hard to figure out, like, when people are being serious or not. It's like, at Grady Balls 69, love to have a shitty day and cry myself to sleep every night, LOL. 10,000 likes, 7,000 retweets. It's like, I don't, we're very hard to read in that way because I think that, like, and again, Twitter is just one metric, but I think we're just more jokey or kind of, like, ironic about it than previous generations. And we hide behind this, like, I don't know. We're just not, you know, to be earnest is so uncool.
That's funny because I read those as sirens. Like, yeah. We joke about it, but, like, yeah, I read that as our generation kind of accepting and not having as much shame around the idea of being sad or lonely or depressed. Like, you will go on a first date and sit down and talk to someone about their dysthymia and exactly what medications they're on. And it's, like, kind of NBD. And sometimes I think that it can move into like this confessional world where if we just all admit that we're depressed, then that's, like, half the battle. And there's not as much focus on, you know, trying to resolve the underlying issue. But I think those kinds of posts get a lot of likes and retweets and stuff because they're like extremely relatable. Like all I do is follow a bunch of those meme generators on Instagram that are like making jokes about my friend texted me one this morning that was like my ideal like weekend is eating Cinnamon Toast Crunch in bed messily and letting the sugar crumbs exfoliate my legs. like that's where we are. And I was like, yes, LOL, that's me, it me.
Yeah, the Twitter account at So Sad Today. Have you guys heard of So Sad Today?
No, tell us about Every day. So Sad Today. Please, listeners, enjoy a new thing to follow.
Every day they tweet like a sort of, you know, hilarious line about being depressed. 761,000 followers on Twitter. And I had to stop following at one point because it was getting to me. It was just too real.
So to end the segment, I was wondering, you know, if there is a, like, not to get too real in the spirit of what Vanessa just said, you know, we proudly have many listeners out there. Many people, there's this phenomenon called parasocial interaction where, you know, people treat listening to podcasts or watching the Today Show or watching Rachel Maddow or something as a social interaction and feel like it's a form of like feeling like part of a community. So a lot of people turn to podcasts for that. And so there might be some lonely listeners out there who are struggling with social isolation. And I'd love to hear if anyone on the panel has advice. Kind of sucks, but if anyone has anything to share with folks who are struggling with this, or what has worked for you and what can be done and how to think about it.
What has worked for me? I would say two things. Number one, occasionally forcing myself to go to things that I have RSVP'd to but absolutely did not intend to go to, just because I prefer being home. And like every once in a while, you make yourself go, and then at the end of it, you usually won't regret it. But the second thing is, you know, there's this, I think our culture in the United States, there's this emphasis on being always happy, and the bar is really high in terms of like what's an acceptable way to be a social human being. And like, if you're a person whose peak happiness is being like alone 60% of the time and 40% of the time being with others, and you know this about yourself, and it's by choice, I think it's okay to also accept that about yourself. You know, like there's nothing wrong with you for enjoying being alone, you know, like if that's where you are. But if it's less by choice, then I think this kind of goes back to what Pete has said, which is, even if the people at the office happy hour who have invited you are wouldn't make your top 100 list of like favorite people to hang out with, make yourself go every once in a while and see what comes out of it. And also keep hanging out with us on the podcast, because like we're kind of your friends.
We are your friends. I've noticed something. I've been going to meetings of the New Orleans DSA recently, and because I'm trying to write about it, and I've actually been, I think one of the most wonderful things about the takeoff of the DSA recently, where it's gone from, you know, like 5,000 members a couple of years ago to like now 50,000, it's just growing exponentially. And I think actually one explanation for that rise in membership is the loneliness epidemic among millennials, where they're looking for something to join and looking to something to be part of. But I have noticed when you go to those meetings that it is just an incredibly refreshing and encouraging experience to be around people who are, you know, I don't want to say who think like you, but people, it's so nice to be reminded that you're not crazy. It's so nice to be around. They have kind of there's a good-hearted atmosphere, at least in New Orleans. This is a city where it's really easy to be social, because even if you try to hide away, there's going to be like a parade coming by your house, like, and they'll like all come encourage you to join. They'll be like, hey, come join the parade, which is great. I think parade culture. So move to New Orleans if you're lonely and you want friends. Come to New Orleans, because everyone will be your friend. People will come up to you on the streets. But no, you know, I think a huge part of political organizations like the DSA, a huge part of why they succeed and what's important about them is the connection that they create between the participants. And I think being part of a political movement and part of organization that's trying to do something in your community is vital. And it really sort of, it's been every time I go, I feel so energized afterwards. I feel so good. I meet people. It's so nice. So my recommendation, join the Democratic Socialists.
So I guess I kind of have three things. So one is I strongly second Vanessa's point about if you are the kind of person who needs a lot of solitude to feel sort of like grounded and yourself, that's okay. So like, I think kind of social media culture to an extent encourages people to really be keeping like friend tallies, or to like to project an image that you're always doing stuff. And it's okay to not do that if you don't want to. Second, like if when you are sad, because I think this is important, like whatever you need to do to not feel like that is okay. Like if you need to read like shitty fanfic or like fall asleep watching like weird ASMR videos, like own it. It's not a problem. Because I think sometimes people feel like they like get into patterns that are like pathological and that they need to like feel ashamed of that. It's not the case. But that said, like I think it's important not to stop there, because like self-care is great and important and really useful. But also I think I've found certainly for myself, like actually going out and like trying to get involved in some kind of organization that like helps people is actually a really great way to like try to not feel sad. And that is not going to work for everyone, because also like if you're got a lot of stuff going on in your life, your like emotional resources to go do stuff like that may be a little limited and it's different for different people. But I think I felt for a long time like I was just like not the right person to be doing that kind of stuff. Like I'm like socially awkward, I'm a little like nerdy, kind of like not always a great communicator, and I really felt like, oh, the sorts of people who go out and like do community work or who like are like, you know, trying to like, you know, talk to struggling people must be people who have this really amazing social skill set. The reality is like people are really, there are a lot of really sad people, and all they're looking for is just like someone to be nice to them for like a little while. And literally anyone can do that. And the need is just so great. And then the nice thing about this kind of work is like it can provide like a sense of community for you if you're not seeing a lot of people. But also like it is actually kind of a confidence booster to realize that like you can like actually make people feel better sometimes. And sometimes that makes you feel better too. So I think if you've never tried that, you should consider doing it. If you don't like it, you don't have to keep doing it. But you might like it more than you think.
Amen to all that. Let's go to break. Hello, listeners. For the past 3 years, the Current Affairs crew has brought you a monthly magazine of culture, politics, and the unusual. For the past year, from the Current Affairs world headquarters to your ear, we have brought everything you love about the magazine into audio form, cutting through the nonsense, bursting open ideological piñatas, and presenting a, we hope, friendly, relaxed, and upbeat guide to the world of politics and culture. And now, for the first time ever, the Current Affairs crew is live in the nation's capital to bring you 2 hours of the pure, unadulterated Current Affairs experience. Serious and not so serious talk about the important issues of the day, the strange and jovial personalities of the magazine's editors, and of course, whimsical gags. What am I talking about? Current Affairs Live, Saturday, January 26th at 8 p.m. at the Rock and Roll Hotel in Washington, D.C. That's right, the first ever Current Affairs Live show in Washington, D.C., Saturday, January 26th at 8 p.m. at the Rock and Roll Hotel. Google Current Affairs Live at the Rock and Roll Hotel and buy tickets now. Tickets are running out, so be sure to get them early. Saturday, January 26th at 8 p.m. Current Affairs Live. Let's get back to the show. And we're back with our final segment, Refresh Our Memory. In the recurring segment, Refresh Our Memory, we aim to remember things that we all have forgotten. This week, we tackle American political amnesia. We Americans tend to forget anything that didn't happen today in American politics. We forgot Vietnam. We forgot that David Frum did bad things. We forgot that Reagan wasn't that popular when he left office. We forgot that Jon Stewart once belittled Dennis Kucinich for defending trans rights. We forgot that many of these Confederate statues were put up way, way after the Civil War. To give just a few examples of what we Americans forget. So I thought we'd go around and share what thing we think is the most significant thing that has fallen down the American memory hole and rectify it by refreshing our memory. Who wants to go first?
I think I may have talked about this on the podcast before because I never shut up about it. And but I've been reading recently over the last few months about the early history of the Socialist Party in the United States, because there is this impression that the United States was exceptional and that it never had a socialist movement. You know, the European countries came close to revolutions or had revolutions, and not the United States. And there's a famous book, Why is there no socialism in the United States? But in fact, there was, and it was. It's kind of fascinating, and I'm still obsessed with the statistic that there were 1,000 socialist office holders in the United States in 1906, which is people who are in the Socialist Party who actually held elected office in state legislatures, and they held, you know, the mayor of Milwaukee, and a lot of different city governments had socialist city councils, and they succeeded in getting you the 8-hour day and instituting workplace safety regulations, and it was incredible. And a lot of this died out with World War One, and was completely buried and forgotten. And you know, they were known for being pretty good, pretty pragmatic city officials. There were no gulags, there were no guillotines. It was practical, sensible, progressive governance. I'm just reading a biography of Eugene Debs right now, which is all about, and I'm reading just so many impressive things happened in American history, people built and did, that are totally forgotten. So I've been reading about the American Railway Union that he built, where he tried, you know, it got just hundreds of thousands of railway workers flooded into this new union because all the unions had failed. They were all not serving their members. So Debs goes, we're going to found a new union, and it's going to have all railway workers in it. And they flooded in and they started winning strikes. And of course, they were eventually crushed, because all of these things are crushed. But along the journey... Just because the things were all ultimately crushed and destroyed doesn't mean we shouldn't look back and see what they did. And so much of this is written, it really is written out of history. It's not just Howard Zinn that says that. I mean, you know, Jill Lepore, who I love, the American historian I love, I wrote about her new history book. She just writes out all of this labor history. It's just not in the conventional history of the United States. And when you read stuff, there's just so much richness, so many wonderful radicals building wonderful things.
Take it out of the memory hole. Our memory is refreshed. Who's next?
So I started watching this show on Netflix called Everything Sucks, which is about these teenagers who live in 1996. And the plot is not super relevant, except for that it's so trippy to be watching this show set with like 11-year-olds in 1996, because there's like a lot of Oasis and stuff. But they also have all of these references to what the outside political world is. And what was kind of jarring is in the first episode, there's like a, they have like a news show, like that does morning announcements and stuff that gets beamed into all of the TV screens in the rooms. This is apparently something that happens in American high schools. I don't know, I didn't grow up in this country, but they give a little news report. And at one point they talk about Clinton signing the Defense of Marriage Act. And they kind of explain matter-of-factly what it is and move on to the next news item. And it's, like, jarring. Because also, like, one of the plot points is that the little girl in the show realizes that she might be lesbian and yada, yada, yada. But, like, it's so bizarre to be thinking about, reminiscing positively about this childhood time, and then to realize how recently something that seems like just my own recent history, our conception of what so-called good liberal presidents did and how far we've come on LGBT rights, it's like
remarkable. I think that that's probably the single fastest moving social issue that we have had. And to hear the words Bill Clinton signs Defense of Marriage Act defining marriages between one man and one woman. I mean, you know, but like, it's nuts. It was so recent and it's so nuts. And everyone has been able to be rehabilitated. Even people like Barack Obama coming around, as they say, in 2013. Like, it's all pretty galling, which is to say that when we have these battles about purity and whether or not the left is being too harsh on people, I think that without purity and without people kind of asking us to be our better selves all the time in these moments, we wouldn't have had the kind of evolution that we've had. And that flashback wouldn't have been galling. It would just continue to be our reality.
Who knows what when... like it's 2030 and someone's like, oh, there's this cool Netflix show that takes place in 2019.
And they're eating meat. Crazy.
And they're like, I cannot believe that a Democrat didn't support the Green New Deal. That's so wild. I have a, and like, look at all of us. We all have solar panel installation jobs and I'm Netflix binging on my day off from my like Green New Deal job guarantee. I'll go next. I have a similar one to Nathan and I both find our memory hole in the turn of the century labor movement, which is a very verdant time. One thing that I've noticed when we talk about unions and when we talk about labor policy, we often talk about outcomes. So like every, you know, month, some meme goes viral, which is like, why do I love unions? I love unions because like, look at the decline of unions and the decline of wages. Or if you asked any Democratic Party official, why do unions matter? I think 100% would say wages and benefits. You know, unions get you high wages, unions get you benefits, unions stand for you. That is like a relatively recent phenomenon, which is to associate unions with the kind of outcomes that unions get. When unions were talked about at the turn of the 20th century, unions were talked about power. They talked about your boss dominates you, and if your boss is in charge and you have no union, you can get fired at any time, so you're justifiably afraid of your boss. When you have a union, your boss is afraid of you. You are no longer dominated. You are empowered. You have a voice. And it was all about agency. It was about increasing the agency of workers and increasing the communal agency of all of them to fight back. And if we only talk about wages and benefits, we're acting like unions are just like another wonky, you know, Vox writer who's like, oh, yes, I found a special thing that will bend the graphs of like outcomes that people want. But that doesn't resonate. You know, wages and benefits are important. I do not want to take away wages and benefits, but wages and benefits are a consequence of power. And so down the memory hole in the American left is a story not just of outcomes that are nice, but of the power that leads to them. And I want to retrieve that. We need to talk about domination and power in response to it.
The opposite. Yes, more talk about domination.
I'll go next. I've written about this before, so this is a little bit lazy, but it also still blows my mind. I wrote this essay for Current Affairs called Every Parent Deserves a Nanny State. And in doing a little research for that essay, I learned that in the 1940s, there was a wartime law in effect called the Lanham Act. And because a lot of the male population had been drafted away, Congress needed more women to enter the workforce. And in order to do that, it understood that it would need to assist the women significantly with childcare. And so it did just that. If you were a woman working in a community that was contributing to the war effort, then, you know, provided that you paid a small flat fee of that, like worked out to be less than 75 cents a day at the time, you could basically obtain close to free childcare. And it was pretty extensive. There were some communities where these childcare centers were open 24/7. And basically, and like that was also, you know, to accommodate women who had the night shift, for instance. But that contributed to like starkly increasing the segment of the labor the labor force, you know, that was constituted of women. And also I found out that for the first time in the country's history, married women even surpassed single women in the labor force. But then as the war wound down, they basically shut down the centers because they wanted women to return at home to free up the jobs for the men. Anyway, childcare is a huge expense for families today. And I guess if you're poor enough, you might be able to get your child into a Head Start program. And there are a handful of cities around the country that have free pre-K, but otherwise you're pretty much on your own. And it feels like it's always been that way. So it's kind of wild to think that almost 80 years ago, the government was willing to pay or heavily subsidize for the opening of these child care centers, you know, at all costs, like whatever it would take to free up women who were willing to enter the labor force. So I don't know. I don't think that's something that politicians emphasize today. And I don't even think there's even like a real fight right now for like free government subsidized childcare other than pre-K. So I don't know. We could be more ambitious. We've done it before.
We don't want to have to rely on those communes. Am I right?
Am I right or am I right?
Okay. So my one, well, it's always hard with some of these because some of them are not so much America forgetting things, but America never fully realizing things and then refusing to ever do so. So my one is the way that we fucked up Guatemala through a deliberate CIA ops. And the tough thing with like CIA ops is like, I feel like as people are very jaded now, like it would, when you tell people like the CIA like orchestrated a coup in another country, it's kind of like if there was like a high profile murder and like John went to jail for it. And then 20 years later, you're like, oh my God, it was Steve. And everyone's like, I knew it was Steve all along. And you're like, no, you didn't, you motherfucker. You never knew it was Steve. And then like, it's just hard to like then like move past that because people just pretend they knew all along. And I feel like everyone's like, oh, I knew the CIA was doing all that stuff. And it's like, no, you didn't. So there are still like 100,000 pages of documents about CIA ops in Guatemala that are still classified. So we don't even know how much. But basically like, in the 1950s, we engineered this coup, and it was very much like the two Dulles brothers of Dulles Airport fame, one of whom was a lawyer for the United Fruit Company, the other of whom was the head of the CIA, arranged to like bring down the democratically elected president of Guatemala. And supposedly this was because they were afraid that Guatemala was going to become a communist outpost. And no doubt there was like some amount of that. But actually, like, the government of Guatemala was, like, a, like, centrist, vaguely left government. They were, like, somewhat progressive. And the main, actually, like, program that they had was unionization, especially on plantations, because they had this basically, like, you know, very much, like, you know, like, large landowners, largely indigenous workforces on these plantations who were very disempowered. And so they came up with this system where basically, like, the plantations could be unionized, and then you could actually, if you're like the plantation owner was abusing you, you could go to the government and basically ask for like some of the land to be like redistributed. It was like a pretty like conservative, like typical like land reform program of the kind that you would expect associated with like democratization. But the United Fruit Company did not want this. So the government had expropriated a certain amount of like the United Fruit Company's lands. So they arranged a fucking coup. And, like, took down the government. And then after that, like, for years, we're, like, basically, like, training people to be, like, terrorists in Guatemala and, like, fudging all the numbers about, like, how many people, like, the leftists were killing versus how many people, like, the government was killing. Like, up until the point where there was literally, like, a genocide happening in Guatemala. And there was still, like, this like, you know, news fiction that it was primarily, like, guerrillas that were doing all the killing when it was, like, very much not. So I don't know. It's just, it's amazing how brazen, like, you can be in the international stage and then just, like, never, ever own up to it ever. Like, the U.S. government's never apologized for doing this. We still pretend to have no idea why there are so many, like, refugees coming from Guatemala or, like, why, like, gang violence is so prevalent there. And it's, like, because we, like, screwed up the entire country. So Yeah. I'm sure this is not news to like most people, but like it still just like blows my mind that we never talk about this ever.
Our memories have been refreshed in many areas. We remember the horrible atrocities of the CIA. We remember the joys of Eugene V. Debs. We remember the bad decisions of William Jefferson Clinton. We remember the once and future nanny state. We remember domination and power. And on that note, let's do our sound off. Brianna Joy Gray.
Bye, guys.
Vanessa A.B.
Good night.
Brianna Renix.
Have a good night.
Nathan J. Robinson.
Farewell.
I'm your host, Pete Davis. Good night. Let's do footnotes. If you hear people criticize the Green New Deal for not having a fully specified blueprint yet, remember that the original New Deal didn't at first either. When Franklin Roosevelt declared at the 1932 Democratic Convention, "I pledge you, I pledge myself, to a New Deal for the American people," he didn't have a fleshed out policy program in mind yet. But Roosevelt's vision of recovery, relief, and reform was soon to be fleshed out through dozens of concrete programs. When polled, 64% of Republicans and 57% of conservative Republicans support a Green New Deal. It's hard to think of a more centrist, bipartisan policy. Yanis V's name is pronounced Yanis Varoufakis. That's Yanis Varoufakis. The quote I was looking for to describe momentum in movements was from The Sun Also Rises. When asked, "How did you go bankrupt?" one character responds, "Two ways. Gradually, then suddenly." That's often how movements work. A casserole is a large, deep pan used both in the oven and as a serving vessel. Food served in such a vessel can also be called a casserole. In the United States, neither parental leave nor universal child care is guaranteed. Many OECD countries guarantee both. Norwegian mothers, for example, are given 45 weeks of leave after having a child. In Britain, every 3- and 4-year-old is guaranteed 15 hours of free child care a week. In his inaugural address, Jacobo Arbenz, the Guatemalan president overthrown for being too far left, stated his goal was to convert Guatemala from, quote, "a backward country with a predominantly feudal economy into a modern capitalist state," unquote. His radical proposals? Infrastructure spending, mild foreign restrictionism, indigenous community empowerment, and land reform to rectify the fact that only 2% of the population owns 70% of the land. Many thanks to Lyta Gold for our delightful bits. You can find her on Twitter at Fluttersnipe. Many thanks to you, the listeners, for sticking with us. It's people like you, and especially people like you who become patrons at our Patreon page at patreon.com/currentaffairs, and also who buy tickets to our live show on January 26th in Washington, D.C. at the Rock and Roll Hotel that make this show happen. You can call in to us anytime at 504-867-8851. That's 504-867-8851. Our theme song is, of course, "The Gherkin Train" by Joe Smith and the Spicy Pickles. This has been Current Affairs.